impact investing is kind of like the idealized version of what business should be. Everyone's benefiting. Your shareholders, your stakeholders, everyone from the janitor to the top up, it's benefiting from good culture, good work. Honestly, a lot of times impact investing, the product itself has a good benefit to the environment, to culture. And so it's putting money where you can see a product or create a positive return financially and socially.
Welcome to the Generosity Now podcast, where we bring you inspiring stories of generosity and whole life stewardship. Our goal is to showcase individuals and organizations making a positive impact in our communities and across the globe. I'm your host, Eric Mose, president of the National Christian Foundation, Rocky Mountain region. And I'm joined by my marvelous co-host, Lori Bossert, VP on our team. Lori, how are you doing today?
I'm having a great day. It's exciting to be able to be here, and especially with Molly and Parker.
That's right. Well, on today's episode, we have the privilege of introducing you to two Zillennials. Yes, I did not stutter those words. You might not have heard. It's not quite a millennial, not quite a Gen Z. They're Zillennials. Parker Samuelson and Molly Sippity. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us join the show.
Well, we are so glad that you guys have taken time. We'd love to hear a little bit more about both of you, your backgrounds, early life growing up, how you came to know the Lord.
Parker, take it away.
All right, I'd be happy to. So I'm Parker Samuelson. I was born and raised in Colorado Springs, and I was blessed to grow up in a Christian family, but I'm very grateful for the way that they raised me with the values and life lessons that that were very helpful for me to grow up and ultimately decide to go to Wheaton College, where I did a double major in Bible and business. And I moved back to Colorado Springs. I worked with my family for a little bit doing real estate development and commodity trading, and ultimately decided to do my own thing. So I'm doing a small boutique real estate private equity investment firm with a friend of mine. We've started a company where we're investing in real estate, mostly in self-storage. So,
hey, Parker, love hearing about little bit of your story. Tell us about how you came to know the Lord.
So yeah, I became a Christian in high school, and you know, some people have a more dramatic faith story than others. I know some people will say, oh, I've just kind of always been a Christian as long as I can remember, just being raised that way. For me, it was actually kind of a more dramatic experience where I had a defining moment where I just had this complete 180 turnaround. It was actually, I want to give credit, I've never tracked this guy down, but there was a guy who was putting on this play, actually, where it was a theatrical rendition of the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. And my mom dragged me to it. And I said, Mom, I want to go to a play. This is so dumb. I hate plays. But she forced me to go against my will. And it was the craziest experience to me. Essentially, the perspective that C.S. Lewis brings is from the perspective of these dark forces that are trying to influence you and in negative ways. And I was just able to identify that in my own life. So I had this totally dramatic life turnaround where it's always been the most important thing in my life since then. And I went to Wheaton College, kind of inspired by Billy Graham. I picked up a book and kind of read about his life story. And studying Bible theology at Wheaton College was also so cool. It's a really, really great program. Some of the best Bible teachers in the world. And I've done a couple of trips to Israel, which also really shaped my faith. But to this day, it's just the biggest part of who I am.
That's awesome. Thanks. Molly, how about you?
Yeah, I think I was raised in a very unique background because even though my family had this huge family business, my dad was given the freedom to not go into the family business, and he loved medicine, but that turned into medical missions. So I had this kind of strange identity growing up from being like a missionary kid who comes from a wealthy family. Those two don't usually ever go together in a sentence. But I think that played a lot into my fate of having one foot in the United States, having one foot out. And so it wasn't until later on that I feel like my faith really formed, maybe for most people, where you're faced with your your big S sin. All right. And some of it through my perfectionism, I felt like I knew where I fell short, but then I still thought I was doing great. But yeah, I think I was really faced with my shortcomings overall, and that even the efforts I did to be a perfectionist fell short. And so that was really in high school where I was faced with that I'm no good on my own. And so I also got the opportunity to go to a Christian school and study Bible, and that was really transformative.
That's great. Well, both of you also have had some pretty life-changing things happen in the last year or two. Tell us, Parker, you mentioned your work a little bit, but love to hear, both of you gotten married recently, and love to hear about your family today. And then also just even a little bit more about a defining moment that kind of has shaped your view of generosity and stewardship.
Yeah, so I am blessed to have gotten married about 2 years ago to my wife, Megan, and we met at Wheaton College and dated for a couple of years and then got married here in Colorado and have kind of laid down roots here and bought a house in Colorado Springs. And that's been the most exciting, fun journey for us. And we've learned so much about each other and about God and relationships and some of those things. But yeah, really blessed for that. And you know, for my personal generosity journey, well, I do have to give credit where credit is due to National Christian Foundation. So the first experience I really had in this whole space was at Wheaton College. So there's a relationship manager there named Roger Sandberg, who ran a journey of generosity for me and about 10 other folks at Wheaton. And we had a blast. And so after having been a part of that, when I moved to Colorado, Roger connected me with the MCF team where I was living then, and then became pretty close with those guys, and especially Eric, and we kind of go rock climbing together and backcountry skiing together and all those kind of things. And MCF has helped me plug into the much wider world and ecosystem. And I'm kind of shouting out MCF pretty big here, but I am really thankful for how it seems like so many different organizations will be very territorial, and they'll say, oh, when anybody slips into our little water tank, we're never letting them out. Like, they're only getting exposed to stuff within our system, and we're going to monopolize their attention. Where my favorite thing about NCF is kind of them sharing and pulling in so many other different groups, kind of from the donor perspective and the ministry perspective. And on the donor perspective, for me, that's groups like Generous Giving and there's just in the Gathering and different organizations that help create community among donors, but then also just getting exposed to what ministries are doing and how they're working together and how they're able to solve problems in a synergistic way. So that's been a big part of my faith, really, is the kind of a generosity journey there.
That's great. Molly, how about you?
Yeah, I feel like my generosity journey was exposed to me growing up. I'm thankful that my parents did that. But I remember early on always knowing that, I don't know how they brought it up, but I always knew that they were giving to organizations. They would let us know the causes. And then, you know, slowly they would let us in. They gave us the little World Vision magazine. And so for Christmas, we got to choose like meals or like a different package. And it was funny because I always wanted to go big. So they said we could choose something from it. And I think my sisters chose like a gardening packet and, like some school supplies. And then I saw the cow was $500, and I had to give a lot of my money towards it too. But it's like, oh, if I can go big with this magazine and splurging, I will. So, but it became more healthy later on. And so through that, my parents always kind of guided us and encouraged us that it would be part of our lives, took us to events and doing with missions overseas. We got to see like on the grounds project my parents were part of. And then I guess I, of course, need to plug NCF. my parents set up an account, a donor advised fund, and they're like, look, this is your giving account. And then you can search organizations and boom, you send a check. And this was before, you know, I learned that, you know, you have to pay taxes in this world. And then, so it's nice to do it all in one place, get your receipts and keep going in life. But overall, it's like, I always saw it as a part of my parents' life. And now, yes, I recently got married a year ago. I call getting married rebranded. So rebranded my last name, which my my maiden name is tied to our family business. And I had a lot of people push back and be like, whoa, are you scared you're losing a legacy? And it's like, no. And I have friends who keep it, who put it as their middle name. I just wanted a new name. And I really want to build with my husband our legacy. And so it's been fun to merge our generosity and do it together.
You guys obviously are a different generation. You're both just getting married. We called you Zillennials. So what do you guys see as unique about your generation?
I think our generation is really unique when it comes to generosity and impact. This might be a little spicy, but these are some of the trends I'm seeing. And I feel like the nonprofit world needs to kind of now shift towards these next generations. For example, I feel like a lot of our generation is way more interested in impact investing. So there is a return on profits, whether you take that or set that aside to reinvest. But you'll always have this mom and pop nonprofit. But for the ones, I think I've seen the fatigue of my parents, and that's maybe more of a personal story of giving to things over time or seeing the fatigue of foundations. And I feel like our generation really wants to impact. They want to do it together too, of, you know, co-investing in these impact groups or co-giving. And so it's not done in isolation, but they really want to see impact happen. So I think nonprofits are going to have to shift to do more special programs or things for different season in order to attract the generosity. People are generous though. This is where I could see it going.
So Molly, and that is super helpful. And I think the four of us all understand what that impact investing is, but can you just unpack that a little bit of what it is different compared to what the charities are needing or wanting today?
Impact investing is kind of like the idealized version of what business should be. Everyone's benefiting, your shareholders, your stakeholders, everyone from the janitor to the top up. It's benefiting from good culture, good work. Honestly, a lot of times impact investing, the product itself has a good benefit to the environment, to culture. And so it's putting money where you can see a product or create a positive return financially and socially.
I think it's good for folks, for organizations to also hear like this shift in mindset. Parker, you got some thoughts on this?
Yeah. So just a really specific example on this, just to kind of really clarify what we're talking about here. So there was a couple of months ago, me and Molly and a couple other of our friends who have been more public in the kind of next gen space. So we were all pinged by somebody who was kind of soliciting us for donation to a nonprofit. And we all kind of texted each other and was like, have you guys seen this too? And we all kind of immediately landed on the same spot. We all landed on saying, we're so confused why this couldn't be an impact investment. And I actually ended up mentioning that. I told this person, I was like, hey, look, I don't want to just ignore you or blow you off. I think there's opportunity for you to switch this from a nonprofit to a for-profit, and you could probably receive an impact investment if your value proposition is credible enough, and you could demonstrate that there's a potential for growth and sustainable growth. And I know that there's even investors in this space will say, look, I'm willing to take a pretty big concessionary return if I can make an impact, and it's an impact investment, but I'm only getting a 5% return. I'm willing to make that investment just because I would rather not have this person come back to me every 6 months soliciting new donations over and over again when it could be more sustainable. I mean, obviously, some forms of ministry are impossible to make as an impact investment, and I'm never going to go tell a Young Life area director that Megan and I support to say, oh, you need to be an impact investment. I mean, that doesn't really make any sense. But there are so many different problems that could be solved better through a sustainable business that has employees and net profitable cash flow on a quarterly basis that doesn't have to keep coming back to the well over and over and over again. So I really do think that I agree with Molly that is a pretty major, major shift. And it's been made possible through a lot of organizations like NCF within the space. And I'll just kind of shout out Impact Foundation as well, that they've been able to kind of create the structure and the ecosystem for that to be possible. But that I just say that example because I hope that organizations hear and understand that it's like if they can pull it off, it's a really big opportunity.
And to kind of tag on to that too, I agree. There's always going to be things that aren't designed for business, but I was even looking at my giving patterns a little while ago, and I have only done between 2 year, one repeat nonprofit from year one to year two. Otherwise, I've continued to switch it up. And some of that has been just my own heart, what's on my heart, what I see, what I've been exposed to. But I see my parents' generation as like maintaining or doing like 3 to 5 year kind of grants or givings. But I think I get excited by what's going on in the world and exposure. And so I want to help move things along. And not that I'm not sustaining things, but it's just maybe a different pattern that's building up among these millennials.
What Molly was actually just talking about is literally just having a conversation with somebody yesterday and about what I see like a changing landscape of how different generations think about giving. Molly was talking about how her parents have had like a sustaining effort with nonprofits where they just give year after year after year. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm seeing this shift where especially this younger generation, Gen Z, Zillennials, Millennials, right, are more project-based. They might come in and support for a year and then kind of move on and things like that. You recently have been on kind of a speaker circuit talking about different things, and you kind of pulled even some of your peers and was asking some of their thoughts on wealth and generosity and transfer. I wonder if you have any more insight for our listeners.
Yeah, I'd be happy to share. So I was thankful to be offered to speak at the Kingdom Advisors Conference this past month. And my first thought was, I want to try to see if I can bring something, some unique perspective and something kind of more data driven, because I'm not an expert. So I thought, well, maybe I can provide some real data so I'm not just making this stuff up. So we polled two different groups. So there's one group called Magnify that Molly and I are both involved in, which is not a very formalized group at all. We have no programming or events or structure or anything. It's just a kind of pretty decentralized community of next gen people, but specifically Christians. So Christian young people, oftentimes from family business families that are trying to kind of figure out this journey of how they're going to be stewarding their family's legacy, but also kind of coming into their own. So then there's another group that's kind of a similar version of that, but a non-Christian version. And so we pulled that group and actually we were pretty excited and surprised by how much of a response we got. But so I'll just briefly share some of the data that we got from that I thought was pretty interesting. So one was we asked folks, how involved are you with your family? And so we asked for philanthropy, investing, neither or both, like where are you involved or not with those different things? And we saw that 75% of next gens were involved. So that's a lot. I mean, for us, that's a lot. So 3/4 of young people are involved. And I would define young people by about 22 to 35, maybe, but oftentimes younger than 30. So these are kind of young adults in their 20s that are very involved. And we kind of distinguish between, well, do you have a voice or do you have a vote? And it seems like oftentimes it's maybe even both. So again, a really high level of involvement that was a little bit surprising. And then, so another interesting question that we asked was, okay, well, how often does your family talk about wealth? And we got about half and half between often and occasionally. So almost no nevers, which was surprising. We thought there'd be more nevers, but most of the families we talked to were actually talking about this. And then probably the most surprising result that we got was we asked, hey, are you going to be receiving assets in an inheritance upon the passing of the previous generation or early or none at all? And so almost 2/3 of the respondents said that they're expected to receive an early inheritance. So again, for us, this is kind of surprising with the whole conversation around the great wealth transfer. For me, this shows that it's kind of already happening where there's these 20-year-olds walking around with significant assets that are then making decisions about how the economy and how investing and philanthropy is operating. So all of these things are already happening because that's again the difference between the voice and the vote. So for me, the way I'm seeing this is more and more of a percentage of people are actually having that vote element of that where they're making these decisions, which I think we were talking to financial advisors, and a message we were kind of subtly saying to financial advisors is oftentimes it's maybe the baby boomer financial advisor who is buddies with his baby boomer client who's kind of ignoring the next generation because they're perceived as they're oftentimes young people aren't taken as seriously but what we're showing with our data is that's kind of a mistake because again, young people are starting to make the decisions, which has major implications for again how the economy and how the whole philanthropy ecosystem functions. And then we also asked how healthy would you describe your family's relationship with money? And so a big chunk of people just said kind of moderate, like not good, not great. But then we got a big chunk of people who said it was either healthy or unhealthy. And so for those, we kind of looked closer at the data and said, okay, well, for people that say that their relationship is healthy or unhealthy, well, what is also true about them? So I'm not going to sit here and say that we can make claims with bulletproof statistical accuracy and with all the right p-values and all this kind of, I can't say that, but just looking at the data, I think at least what's true for these groups, I don't know how much we can kind of extrapolate, but just for these groups, we thought the results were interesting, which is this. The results for us showed the healthy group and the unhealthy group. So again, we ignored the middle ground and only looked at the extremes. And the interesting thing was the responses were really similar, except for one or two key differences. So for us, the healthy group and the unhealthy group, both were very financially literate, were involved in both their families investing and philanthropy. And high level of involvement, high level of personal financial literacy. But the difference to us was the voice versus the vote thing. So for me, the unhealthy group kind of knew everything. They were really involved, but they didn't really actually have any personal agency. And the healthy group kind of knew everything, was very involved, and actually did have a voice and a perspective. Whereas for me, the moderate group maybe weren't as involved at all. So maybe they just kind of aren't as connected to the family stuff, and they just kind of go get a job as an engineer and just kind of live their own life. So for me, I thought that was an interesting perspective where to me, it's like, it's almost, and again, I'm no expert, but to me, it's almost telling me if you are going to pull the next generation in, it's probably best to go ahead and give them some form of agency, because otherwise it might even be better just to not even pull them in at all. And just kind of let them go on their own journey. So that's kind of the data that we got. And we thought it was kind of a fun, interesting study, but still kind of wanting to learn more and interested to see what other perspectives people have on that.
Parker, it sounded like in that last section of talking about having a voice or not, part of it is as you're invited in, there's a little bit of an expectation that you're going to be allowed to have an opinion in that voice. Mm-hmm. And that's where when the older generation, which really is what I represent, you're educating me and helping me realize that when I want to have the conversation and bring my children and the next generation into this, that I need to respect that they're going to have a different opinion and that I want to learn that opinion. I don't want to just invite them in and have it be my way, but that we need to be able to really hear, because you guys have, you know, a very different generation culture that you grew up in than what I grew up in.
Totally. Yeah. And so, I'll just quick. Yeah, go ahead.
As I say, what other advice would you have? Like, I want to hear back of, give me some more helpful hints in that space.
Yeah. Well, to me, I kind of go back to a podcast that me and another gal run, that we're actually grateful to Molly for the idea of this podcast. So we run a podcast called Ascendance, where it's young adults that are trying to kind of ascend into their own legacy. But you know, there, I feel like the qualitative narratives and case studies that we've seen through that podcast do kind of reflect our data a little bit, where some of the healthiest examples of families that we've found do have young adults that are involved and have a high level of personal agency. So again, I think oftentimes the baby boomer generation can be really worried. They say, oh, if I expose the next generation to this stuff, it's instantly going to ruin them. And I think of, so the very first episode that we did is a really good friend of Molly and I's named JC, who lives in Fort Collins, and his family owns Otterbox. And so for our friend who's kind of in that younger generation, when he graduated from college, he started his own company called Angel Armor, which we joke is Otterbox for humans, where it's body armor for police officers and military personnel. And so, and it ended up being a really successful company. And for me, I just think that is so cool, where he's able to pull some wisdom and experience from his father, who knows kind of the ins and outs of material science and all the, and how to start a successful business and do some of those things. So when he's able to create this business on his own, just the level of empowerment that comes from him being able to run his own business. And again, and it would be wrong to say, oh, well, it's just because you're from a successful family. That's just not true. I mean, the level of business acumen that this guy has as a next gen guy running his own successful business, getting contracts from police departments and military agencies. I mean, there's no way to explain that away except for the fact that it's a really healthy dynamic where there's a multi-generational kind of iterative legacy building that's taking place, where each generation isn't just kind of consuming and just wasting resources, but they're utilizing the resource as a foundation to springboard into their own, to spark their own legacy. And to me, I just think that's so cool where, so I think in a quadrant of healthy versus unhealthy and high level of agency versus not a lot of agency, for me, that's kind of best case scenario, where there's the agency and they're stewarding it in a way that's kind of God honoring and honoring to their family legacy. Whereas, there's also obviously examples of the flip side of that, where there's agency given where there probably shouldn't be. And there's mistakes that have been made where the next generation isn't prepared or isn't ready, and they are kind of ruined. I mean, that's obviously possible. And we run the risk of our podcast of only telling the good stories. So there's obviously the downside risk there as well. But honestly, from our study that we did, it does make me think that it is actually a pretty safe alternative to just kind of not even really pull them into the inner layers of that and just kind of let them go do their own thing and just kind of go to college and get a job. And I mean, to me, that there's nothing wrong with that. But to me, it's like, if you are going to try to pull everybody in, that's when you really have to be intentional about it and have like wisdom and professionals and advice. And to me, again, from the study, it makes me wonder if you are going to go for it and kind of pull the next generation in, it's really, you really want to be ready to kind of give them a voice and a vote at that point. Because again, the worst case scenario in our group were the people that were pulled into everything, and maybe they know anything, maybe their siblings are involved, but they're not. And so they're kind of in this in-between where now they know everything. And they have a high level of personal financial literacy. So they think to themselves, well, I could make a difference. And if I actually did have a vote, I could help and contribute, but I'm kind of just shackled here and I can't do it. I can't help in any meaningful way. So to me, that is kind of almost the best case, worst case. But but it's hard to kind of pull conclusions from this stuff because there is such a lack of data and nobody talks about it and it's very mysterious. And so it's all kind of a journey of trying to figure it all out.
Two things come to mind when I think about one generation impacting the next to kind of steer them with all the best intentions. Is the first one is I did a program with some friends and they give this really helpful example of language around transactional versus relational. And money is such a tough thing because it's a very transactional language. And even when you put it into generosity, even I think about me and my sisters would talk about how like, oh, we want to be like our parents, you know, we want them to like look at our generosity and think like, well done and all these things. And so when you have conversations about generosity, make sure you're getting to that relational heart. And I think part of that relational heart is taking a step back from the transactional and giving some freedom of choice and guiding. And the second example kind of goes along with that of how I feel like my parents did that well. And it kind of, might be a weird example, but my parents really wanted to make sure that we had a healthy relationship with the quality of wine. And so what they did was when we were younger, they would introduce wine to us and they diluted it with water. They placed it with our meal and they said, all right, you guys want to try like a little bit, dip your steak in it. And, you know, we ate some and at first our kid reactions were like, this is disgusting. And then maybe a year later we tried again and it'd be a little less diluted. And as time went on, it'd get less diluted. It wouldn't grow in amounts. I should say that it was very appropriate. But I think about that in terms of wealth being like a wine bottle. You see a lot of people just get handed this bottle without ever trying it or being like, oh, this is gross or this might be good, but like have a safe environment and see its beautiful purpose of when wine is eaten with food and with friends and celebration, it's a beautiful thing. But when it's taken out of context, it can be really damaging. And so I feel like the same can be done with generosity of what my parents did with, here's a little book, like, what do you want to give to? All right, let's set up an account so that just like we talk about in our faith, being trusted with a little so that we can be trusted with a lot. What are these practices where we can mess up or on small scales so that it's safe so that when the bigger scales come, we have more stewardship of that. And so I'm really thankful that my parents did that. There's always like more things or like investing and all these things I wish I had that with, but I'm very thankful that they did that with generosity and with alcohol.
Molly, speaking of, I mean, you are also involved with the family's kind of impact investing and making some suggestions there. How has that been kind of for you? Have you enjoyed that? Like, what really gets you excited there?
Yeah. So when impact investing was first coming on the scene, I was talking with my parents about it and just kind of wanted to jump in with them. And it was interesting because at the time I was talking to a private equity group of getting training from them. And the guy was like, all right, you know, private equity is great. He's like, you know, you'll invest in 5 companies and 4 will fail. And the one that wins, like, will the profits will outweigh the 4 that failed. And I was like, this sounds terrible. And he was being honest and stuff. But when my parents and I were introduced to impact investing, I think we liked it because of the people and ideas. But to see that, oh, there is this redemption aspect to doing multiple layers of business and doing it well. We even talk about what are impact companies that exist today just because they do good business. You know, they aren't looking for that startup investment phase. And so we've learned a lot through it. It's not guaranteed. And I think we've gotten exposure through faith-based startup competitions like Lion's Den and Praxis. But for me and my family, we see it as if you're going to claim your faith and do business, the standard is much higher for you because I think people can easily invest like, oh, they're a believer too. They must have these things. It's like, nope, due diligence still happens. And so it's been a joy to see how do we apply these like everyday business principles to faith and to people of faith with their business.
Yeah, we had in the past, we had Tim McCready on the podcast and him, and then a conversation with Matt Munson with Sovereign's Capital, and the danger of some church parking lot deals, and where people are like, oh, well, I know this person, and I'm just going to make this investment and not do thorough due diligence and such. And it kind of slowed down, I think, some of the start of impact investing. But I think we're maturing beyond that. But it's something to definitely pay attention to for sure. Hey, you both have had the joy of traveling extensively and being a part of some pretty incredible projects. I'm curious, was there something in your upbringing that feeds you today in the work that you're doing?
Well, it's funny that you say that on just the travel perspective, because my family never leaves our hometown. My family never travels, so it's probably kind of counterintuitive in that way, but it was almost like the opposite of how I was raised is kind of what contributed to my personality, where my wife and I love traveling, and we just kind of took a year last year, and I was kind of in a spot where I was able to work remote, and so we just lived internationally and went kind of all over the world, and we had so much fun. For me, I've always just loved gaining as much of an international perspective as I can, and even specifically just kind of within the kingdom of God. One thing people asked us when we were leaving, okay, are you going to keep watching your home church on live stream? I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. So what we did was wherever we were on Sunday, we would just go to church there. And it was such a cool experience. So we went to Eastern Orthodox in Greece, and we went to Roman Catholic in Italy. And we went to the biggest mega church in the world in Seoul, Korea, which was kind of cool. It was interesting, but, so we went to all these different places and we went to a Hillsong church in Vienna and met all these other young people who were like, I feel like we would be friends in America. But they were kind of struggled with their English and things like that. So it's just so fun gaining an international perspective. Or I'm in college. I did a job with Young Life Africa. And again, meeting these guys who are doing Young Life in Kenya, I thought I would be friends with you guys in America. And we would do a Young Life club in Kenya, kind of in the jungle, in the northwest part of the country. And the way the kids were acting, there's like the funny kid who was the class clown getting all the attention. And there was this guy, the kind of a shy kid. I was like, this is the same exact thing. This is the same exact thing as when I grew up in Colorado Springs. So for me, it's so fun being able to kind of gain that international perspective and kind of challenge myself to kind of try to break out of my little small vision that I have of the full complexity of God's creation. So yeah, I've tried to do that with even just from a generosity perspective as well. There's different ministries who have kind of figured it out of how to actually make impactful change in different places around the world that are just tough. One that I think of is like the International Justice Mission, for example, where there's a book I read this summer that really changed my perspective called The Locust Effect, where he says, okay, we're giving all this money to these different countries, and we're giving food, and we're giving this, and we're giving education, and we're giving, but his name of the book, The Locust Effect, is it's like, you can do everything right, and you can kind of grow your crops, and everything you do is by the book, and you got good weather, but then out of nowhere, the locusts just come and eat everything, and then you declare bankruptcy and your family falls into poverty for a generational cycle for him, the analogy is violence, where there's some places in the world where it's like without the right justice system in place or the right court system or the right judicial oversight and correctional officers and things like that. It's hard. It's just really challenging to kind of move up the ladder, where for me it's seeing the way that all these different organizations all interlock together, and they're not really competing against each other, going back to the kind of rooting for rivals concept, but they're all, it's like you need all these different pieces of the puzzle but while still not losing sight of the fact that there's homeless people within a mile of where I live that are struggling. So it's just trying not to lose sight of that dichotomy. And it is challenging trying to think through, okay, I've got a finite amount of money in my donor advised fund. How can I balance? Am I giving to groups in Kenya that are doing X, Y, and Z, or am I giving to groups a mile away. I mean, that's a kind of a lifelong journey of trying to figure that out.
It is neat that how we can, when we do the travel, we see how God created all people in his image and similar, and we can see that similarity. And as you even talked about, the poverty that can be overseas can also be seen in our backyards. And right. It's across all of those places, all the continents, all the cities. And God calls each one of us to respond in different ways. So Molly, tell us a little bit about your travel.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because out of my travel came some of the shaping of my passions now, but not in the way you would think. I think because my parents definitely did travel to extreme with being overseas for a year or two at a time or months at a time all throughout my schooling journey until college, I had this one foot in and one foot out where I would be, you know, we'd be living in very poor countries and seeing the worst of the worst. And then I'd come back to my school here and not know how to talk about that with my peers. It definitely opened my eyes, but it was very isolating. And so it was later that I reconciled more of like, this is a really unique perspective to see kind of all that the world has to offer from wealth to extreme poverty and what's effective in missions and givings. But I've noticed that a passion on my heart is that since graduating and working and doing actually impact investing for my family at times is that I, you know, I'm a woman, I'm highly educated, I come from a great family, but I'm still hitting barriers. And so it's made me passionate for women's education just starting from the beginning. It's like, man, if I've been given everything I possibly can to cheer me on and I still hit barriers, like how can I give those who are just starting off on their education journey or empowerment journey more tools? As well, kind of similar to the backyard thing of like, I was faced with such extreme poverty overseas that it was later on and more in high school and college that I got involved with issues more locally, whether it was illicit massage parlors and police work was shutting that down. But then my husband works in documentary film and he's working on a project in the Deep South. And I went down with him as we were doing a tour. And I remember I was like, I'm not in the U.S. I have not seen poverty like this in my backyard, because when I did, I left to go see poverty and then come back. I knew there were issues. I knew there was homelessness. But to see the deep poverty within the U.S. or this country that I had, you know, even when we were overseas, people had such grander ideas of, has been really interesting. So even now, later in my life, I'm still learning, and I know I always will.
That's so great. Well, we like to often ask our guests, it's been so great having both of you on here, if you have a helpful resource that our listeners should check out, a book, a podcast, a website, something that anything comes to mind other than the Ascendance podcast, which we'll go ahead and link here, Parker, as well.
One thing I would say is this has been so helpful for me is to not do this journey alone. So the way I've found community and kind of starting it was just going through starting to go to conferences. So whether it's The Gathering or the NCF conference, where you find other like-minded believers. From there, you can find people with similar backgrounds, whether like in the wealth space or the building wealth space. And I think that's been so helpful for me of, like Parker said, with doing these studies and stuff, it's like there's such a variety of people's stories because it's very private, and it should be private to an extent. But the more I've talked about it with people in safe places, the more I hear like, oh, you've experienced that too, or like, does your family require prenups or like require a certain level of generosity? Are all the females supposed to run the foundation while the men get to do the investment stuff? And so I think there's a lot of camaraderie, and there's a lot of people out there that are looking for that community. It's not crazy exclusive, but you can find it if you start to look, and that's been helpful.
One of the things that I was going to bring up was how you guys met was one of those types of organizations, right, Molly?
Yeah, we met through this organization called Core Venture, which does a lot of great, like, how would you say it, Parker? Like self-empowerment work and emotion. It's like a holistic approach to your identity with wealth and without wealth, kind of within the family and outside the family. They're the ones I mentioned who did the language of transactional versus relational. And so Parker and I met, we had met at a conference, actually, one of these startup investing conferences. And then from there, we both kind of knew each other and got plugged into this program. And one more additional funny thing, I think because we were millennials, is Parker and I got invited to this social media influencers conference, but it's because we were seen as influential with our families, but neither of us had social media. So we walked into this room and we're like, what are we doing here? But it's kind of like I just mentioned, of slowly putting yourself out there and seeing where those safe connects are.
Yeah, I would echo that, which is, so for me, thinking of a good resource, it's not, my answer to that question would not be, oh, here's some really smart, wise thing that I have to say or some book that I read. For me, it's just get plugged in. So for me, and I hope that relationship managers around the country are, for NCF, are as good as ours that we have here in Colorado, because for me, our NCF team makes it super easy, where they kind of have the calendar and it's like, okay, here's the things, and kind of show up to whatever you feel like or don't feel like. And our group that Molly and I are in, this Magnify group, which again, we don't really do our own programming, but we kind of just, we have somebody who just every couple months, she'll just post a reminder of, oh, here's the whole calendar for the whole year of all the things. And you can kind of show up if you have a capacity and interest and whatever you want to. So for me, that looks like just going to a bunch of different events. So kind of the gathering or the generous giving or, so many different really fun events throughout the year where it's just so much more fun to do it in community than on your own. Because for me, I could just sit here on my own and just think really hard and try to just figure it all out. But it's like, I'm not going to be able to do that without talking to people that are older than me, more experienced than me, wiser than me, every once in a while at this conference, you'll meet somebody who says, I've spent the last 30 years trying to figure out how I can address poverty in Mozambique. And I thought, oh my gosh, so cool. And then whenever I meet somebody who wants to learn more about that, it's like, okay, why don't, instead of you trying to figure out all on your own, why don't you guys just talk to each other? And rather than, another thing on that with NCF that I've appreciated is, it's like, hey, all of you guys are all giving to different organizations within Denver that's doing the same exact thing. And these organizations aren't talking to each other. So it's like, what if we just kind of get everybody together and just kind of figure it out? And so that's my biggest advice to anybody is, I'm like, just, hey, kind of just plug in and just get involved and just be around the table with all these other people. And you'll almost just kind of start absorbing it, which I think is kind of the model that Jesus had with his disciples, is he wouldn't just do these lectures where he just said, okay, come back next week, same place, same time, and I'll just talk at you. It's like, no, we're all going to be friends and we're going to hang out and go do a bonfire. And then we're going to go walk to Galilee and talk along the way. And that, so that's what I think of for generosity too. It's like, find your crew and your guy who's maybe ahead of you in the journey that can kind of guide you along the way and just kind of do it all together and have fun. So that's how I think of it.
That's great. You know, every generation seems to worry about the new upcoming generation. But I must say, spending time with you both today and as I have over the years and as we have, I'm super encouraged about the potential of your generation and the impact of the nations for the glory of God. And there's much that I've actually learned from both of you. And I'm grateful for you guys. We are grateful for you guys taking the time to be with us today on the Generosity Now podcast, where we do seek to inspire, equip, and connect our listeners for generous kingdom impact and whole life stewardship. For more information on us, please check us out at ncfgiving.com/Rocky Mountains and generositynow.org. Please go ahead and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a 5-star review and share it with your network. And Lori's got a doxology for us out of 1 Timothy today.
Let no one despise you for your youth, but set the believers an example in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, in purity. Until I come, devote yourself to the public reading of scripture, to exhortation, and to teaching. And I just want to thank you both because you both have taught me, and I just really appreciate that. And I hope that we all can have hearts to just learn, to learn from others and to walk the road together.
Great having y'all.
Love it. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.